Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is Ingrid Christensen, and she will be speaking on We Are the Stories We Tell, Our Own Stories. So let's listen in on Ingrid Christensen.
Those of you who are familiar with what I often do at Holden Village, which is read a story, are going to be disappointed to hear that I'm not going to read a story today. I will read stories again on Friday and Saturday, and we'll talk about them. But today, I'm going to talk about stories in our lives, and then ask you to sketch out or write a story about your life, which is why I have paper and pencil here. Because I've been thinking a lot about stories lately, and I think that there's a book entitled We Are the Stories We Tell, and I do think that stories are terribly important to our lives and undervalued. And I also think that there's something political about this, which I will explain to you. People have always needed stories. People have always had stories in their lives. We use stories in Bible stories. And obviously, how do we teach about the Bible? How do we teach children? We teach by using Bible stories. Native cultures hand on truths through story. You can go in our bookstore and get stories from Native American traditions, stories from African traditions, stories from African American traditions, stories from Norwegian tradition. Children learn by stories. We have that's the way we teach our children, is by telling them stories. So it's only us, it's only sort of middle-class, well-educated adult Americans that have abdicated stories, have quit claiming stories as a thing that we use to understand our lives, to share our truths, to communicate with one another, to work out what we mean by what we do. I think in our church, this is my little political point on this, I think that when we say that certain of our lives are not acceptable. Gays and lesbians come to mind as the sort of first example of that, but single parents or single people or different kinds of cultural people or poor people or, you know, when some kinds of people are not honored and blessed in our churches and in our lives in forthright ways, I think it robs those people of their chance to tell their story, and therefore of their voice. Whenever we feel that we are going through an emotional experience that we can't talk about, for whatever reason, I think it's stifling. I think it's not good for us. I think the way we make sense of our lives is often by telling stories about them. That's why when I thought about single people, I thought, well, when I go home at the end of the day, if something has happened at work or however that is upsetting to me or that is fun and exciting, I live with a partner and I tell him the story. I can't rest until I find him and make him listen to my story. And when I tell him my story, I find that the story has form. It has a beginning and a middle and an end. It has value. It has values. When I tell him the story, there are assumptions about what we eat, what we share as values, about what my role was in the story, and how I was a good person. I mean, one of the reasons I want to tell him, my partner, my story, is to tell him I was a good person in what I did there. I did it for, even though on the surface it might look like I was mean, which I often appear to be on the surface, or, that I did something less than charitable, I want someone in this universe to understand why I did what I did, and to honor me for that, and to say, to give me an absolution, to say it was good, it was okay. And I think that that is something that we all need in our lives.
Lunch.
Oh, okay. We haven't done anything wrong. And so when I listen to my lesbian friends talk about their lives, one thing I've struck with is how hard it is for them to tell the story of their life, to tell the story of events, specific events in their lives, of longer-term events in their lives, how they can tell the story of their loved ones, their families, the deaths of people, the births of people. It's so complicated when you can't use your life as your ground of being for telling your story. And I think that that is a serious problem, because when people can't reflect their story out, I suspect it does them grave harm. And I don't know, I mean, those of you who are single in this room now and who are maybe not living with someone can talk about your lives in that way. Stories have, excuse me for this frog in my throat, stories have beginnings, middles, and ends. I'm an old English teacher, so Nolte is too. I imagine there are others of you in this room. A beginning of a story often lays out the who, what, where, when of the story. It talks about, it sets the stage for a story. And the story can be about something that happened in 15 minutes or 30 seconds, or it can be about something that happened in a day, or it can be about a death that occurred over 3 months, or it can be about a lifetime. But every story sets a stage in some way. It starts out with a phrase like, once upon a time. From once upon a time, you learn a lot of things. You learn that you're not supposed to pin this to yesterday or tomorrow, but that you're supposed to give it a different kind of thinking about when it occurred. If the story starts out on Mother's Day in 1974, you know a fair amount about what this author is telling you. Or if it starts out, Jake and I went to the lake for the fourth and final time. You know, that. Already the way a story starts tells you a fair amount. A story could start, when Daddy died, something. Any one of those phrases, I think each of you could write a story about today. You might change the name, but I think the beginning of a story, sort of, you don't have to emphasize all of those things, who, what, where, when, but some of that stuff happens to help your reader get a grip on your story and help you get a grip on it, because your story does take place in time and place. The biggest failing of my English students in college is that they don't think little tiny specific details are important, but grown-ups know they are. We all know that the little specifics about our lives are what make our lives important. The middle of a story is what happened, the particulars of what happened, what the tension was, how it was resolved. That's the story. The end of a story is interesting because the end of a story can be just the end of what happened, and it can be despair, it can be hope, it can be that you would choose to rewrite the story, or the end can be looking forward. It doesn't have to be the punctuation at the end of it, but it can be saying, well, let me tell you a story. I had a class in women's studies with 12 college women, and we were studying women in work. This was 3 years ago, maybe. And I thought that an interesting thing about women in work is the oldest profession, which, as you know, is prostitution. So we studied women as sex workers, as prostitutes, for one segment of my class. And for that segment of the class, I asked a woman who was a prostitute to come to the class. I had met her by going to women's court and observing a set of trials of prostitutes. She arrived at my class one morning wearing a businesswoman's elegant, expensive, well-cut suit. This was in the wintertime, and she was in a gold, with gold jewelry, heavy gold jewelry, beautiful suit. She looked for all the world like she was the CEO of some big corporation. And she came in and spoke to my students about her life in a way that was riveting. She was very articulate. She was very compelling. She told the story of her life in a way that was charming and funny, stylized. She told about how her father had put her on the street to earn money when she was 14 and how she'd stayed in the life over that time, but she'd learned how to get to become a high-class call girl, working out of a hotel, making lots of money. She was now, she said, toward the end of her career because she no longer, she was too old to be a high-class call girl, and she was beginning to take cheaper, and she described the various rungs on the ladder of prostitution, how the cheapest thing is you work a street corner and earn $5 per 15 minutes, and then you work your way up, and then you evidently work your way down at the end. She said that she had a 13-year-old daughter, and that at that point, I could see that there was something. I mean, she said, she told this whole story as though this was her choice, this was her life, she was successful, look at her, who could question this? But there was a little crack in her face when she said she had a 13-year-old daughter, because she was clearly thinking that this child was coming up on the age where she had been put on the street, my friend Deborah. But she said her daughter was going to be fine, her daughter was living with her sister was going to take good care of this child. And so when she finished, at the end of this story of her life, she and I were having a lot of fun and talking back and forth, and our students were all laughing, and there was a lot of high color in everybody's cheeks. We were all having a wonderful time. Deborah and I exchanged earrings, because she admired my earrings and I admired hers, and this was sort of a bond of friendship. I had a 13-year-old daughter at the same time. Our daughters were born the same month of the same summer. We had some bonding between us. And then at the end of the session, my students applauded her. She stood up to go. She and I, Deborah and I, walked out on the porch of our office. And it was as though someone had taken a hammer and shattered her face. And all of a sudden, her face just collapsed. And she looked at me, and tears started down her face. And she said, "Ingrid, I have never told the story of my life before, and I don't like the ending." Mm-hmm. So it was a life-changing experience for her. And she said, "Will you be my friend? Will you help me out of this?" And I said, "Yes." And maybe a month later, she called me at 5 o'clock in the morning, on the verge of killing herself, and said that she'd been off heroin for 3 days after 20 years of addiction. The heroin had not entered the picture when she told the story to us. And would I help her? So she got into treatment, and she took her to a drop-in center run by some nuns for hookers, and, you know, the story went on from there. But she decided, after telling her story once, to rewrite the ending, which was phenomenal, I thought. The power of story in our lives. So I would say that the endings of stories are more ambiguous than the beginnings and the middles. But I think the beginnings and middles are important, because I think how you talk about the beginning of your story tells you what you think is the important thing about your story. It tells you, when did this story begin? I was going to tell you the story today of my grandmother's death, and I couldn't figure out how to do it, because my grandmother's life had so many things that went into that story. My grandmother died on Mother's Day. And she died in my mother's arms in a beautiful, absolutely beautiful death. It was a death we should all wish for. But I couldn't quite tell you the story because it's too long, because I had too many threads that had to be explained back into her life. But it is a lovely story. Someone should write that story. So what I would like you to do today is to write a little story. And we're going to take 20 minutes out of this session. Tate Ministry knows they're going to shut the tape off. For 20 minutes, I want you to work on your story. And I would like you to choose, if you can, to choose to write a story about something really close to your heart, something that's bothering you, some pain in your life, some pain in a loved one's life that's close to you, something that you got through in life by the, a close call, or something you failed to get through that was a really heartbreaker. I think stories can express despair, and it's one way for us to finally begin to deal with our feelings of despair. And I think there's real cause for despair in many things in our lives. So I would like you to write a story today, and you can just outline it if you want. You don't have to write it out. But write it out if you want, or outline it, or even put it in a poem. And then those of you who are comfortable sharing them at the end, tell us your stories, is what we'll come back together to do. The history, I think we're going to start up again. I have to say that the intense looks on people's faces were very riveting and important somehow. The idea that you took this assignment seriously and wrote about it is moving to me. I looked around the room and was quite honored or something. It felt pretty wonderful. I wonder whether anybody has written a story or sketched out a story or outlined a story that they would like to share with the rest of us.
I'd be willing to share mine.
Okay, good.
I had a little trouble thinking of one that I think comes out with a pretty good ending, but I did.
You're not required to have a happy ending in your story.
About 4 years ago, I discovered the value and necessity of therapy to change myself for a better life. Before, I thought psychiatrists and psychologists were for people with serious mental problems such as schizophrenia and so on. Now I believe everyone can have and make a better life for themselves with the help of a good therapist. I have been single for a year. I would have been single four years ago, and having terrible guilt feelings and blaming myself beyond what I was responsible for the death of a marriage. Now I'm still going to counseling and working on myself, so I won't do the same thing over again and to make a better life for myself. Writing is one thing I don't like to do, but when I do, it is one of the biggest helps in becoming healthier. Because of this and many other helps, such as counseling, the helps of counseling and support groups, such as Koinonia Singles Group is what I belong to in Longview, Washington. I feel good about my direction in life, and I am getting better at dealing with my problems, and I feel good about myself. That's it.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
You're welcome.
I'm glad that if it's a true story, which of course it doesn't have to be, I'm glad that things are going better.
Well, I like to promote therapy because I think it's good for people who don't think they need it.
Someone else have something they'd like to share? Shy now.
She's volunteering other people.
That's very interesting.
You better go ahead.
I'll do mine.
Okay, good.
Tomorrow's project at Narnia is a tissue paper collage. After seeing an example of the project that I have carefully constructed myself, the children are free to rip, shred, crumple, and arrange the many colors themselves. To paint each piece with liquid starch to hold it in place, and to create ultimately a random collection of shapes and discovered colors that becomes oddly beautiful when held up to a light. A stained glass window that captures the eye and welcomes the imagination to see makeshift crosses, farm animals, and torn lambs inside. I wonder if I'm wise to make the first window. Of course, I mean it to be a demonstration, an example of materials use. But in the end, am I creating more than a first draft? Maybe in truth, I'm turning a simple art activity into an exercise of ego. Perhaps I'm training people smaller but likely more open and loving than myself to imitate instead of simply enjoying the slimy feel of starch, the delicacy of the tissue, or marveling as colors blend gradually into each other. Tomorrow's project at Narnia is a tissue paper collage. If you stare closely and long enough at my prototype, gradually you can discern the shape of a dinosaur. I'm concerned as a teacher that the activities we do are more product-oriented than process, and that the children are not the focus of the activity. And by saying that my prototype, my example of what it's supposed to look like, images of dinosaurs, my metaphoric way of saying, old teaching styles are defunct, archaic. They are, and the Christ images I used with the kids, the stained glass window, the crosses, farm creatures, and torn lambs inside. I think that we are sacrificing a lot of children's creativity by making these examples of what they're supposed to be doing. So, anyway, you asked for something that was on my heart and concerning me right now.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful story. Mm-hmm. Wonderful imagery.
Yeah.
And great use of language to describe those colors.
Yeah.
Oh, it was just wonderful.
Yeah, it was so wonderful.
She brought you into it to help her solve the dilemma. You're right in there solving it for her.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
That's right. We were right with you there.
Mm-hmm.
So you were not only an artist, but a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I hold off writing a lot because, well, this whole topic intrigues me. I don't mean to take the floor here and derail what everybody else wants to say. It's just as important. But I feel that being a single mother, my story is silenced over and over and over again. And it's so hard to find a receptive audience.
Mm-hmm.
An audience is everything. I could feel safe just saying I teach at Narnia, the children tomorrow at Narnia. You all know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Half the things I would write about in my real life, people would question, they would argue with. My audience would not be receptive or not even understand my story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's my biggest problem, making concessions to the audience. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to blab on that.
And your son looks like he's just growing to the sun, and he's so beautiful, and he's so happy, and it's so much fun to see him here. So,
one thing I encountered when I was a single parent is people always said, because I was a writer, why don't you share your experiences? It's very hard to share those experiences when you're living them. You might have the feeling, oh, well, I could help somebody else, but... It's real.
It's sometimes easier to tell a story about something in your history, something that's a little bit finished, wrapped up in some way, still alive for you, but...
That's what I did.
Well, why don't you?
That's a little harder to do it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe someone else did that too, I don't know, but I've been thinking a lot about children. I see them around here and their happiness, and they're reading to each other, and it's just, you know, when I think of the children that have hurts and separations and pain. And so this is what came out of my past. Okay? Just one little incident.
Okay.
We were just married. My husband was newly ordained. We took our few belongings and drove to our first four-point parish in the Turtle Mountains of North Dakota. The furnishings of the little house was very limited, but I loved the pretty blue and white curtains and the tablecloth and our lovely bedroom set of oak, which is still a part of my life. Our first daughter, Vicki Joan, was born in April. It was a lonely time for me, with a feeling of sadness and a post-birth depression. It was 1945. We heard bits and pieces of news from the war, the scattered truths of what was happening to families and children. And I dreamed, and I dreamed a nightmare of someone taking my precious baby, and I was afraid. And when I awoke, I held my baby close and cried for all the other mothers. Becky is grown now, and I hold my grandchildren, and we share our lives in knowing ways, remembering. And I remember the tragic times of thinking of children today who are separated, troubled, and hurt, and I feel a mother's pain.
That's lovely. And I think those early years of being a mother are hard, and everyone thinks you're just blissed out. And I think the early years of being a pastor's wife were probably hard too, being in a four-part
parish. And we had a baby baptized in 10 days that was really weak. My mother had died that year. Oh. And I sobbed uncontrollably. I didn't realize how hard that was going to be. My poor husband was new, you know, too, so I'm sure he suffered with it.
And he probably didn't understand what was going on with you.
Well, it would happen to be your Mother's Day, too, so
I'm sure. That's probably not.
Everybody had how hard that was. That's a long time ago.
Seems like those stories aren't told enough. Stories about women's lives, those things that so many of us share, but we don't see reflected anywhere in literature. So those are important stories.
And they're just as fresh as yesterday. The blue and white tablecloth, the oak bedroom set.
Yeah.
It's like you were there yesterday.
Yeah.
And all the war things were brought back with this.
Yeah.
It would have been our 50th anniversary, so everything comes back, you know?
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. That was a wonderful story.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I'm not telling the story, but I was in Europe 3 years ago, and I have to meet a cousin that would have been my mother's, and she was in a retirement home, and she published a book. It was in manuscript form, and all the people that were in this retirement home got together and each took a chapter in their life to tell a story, their story. And, you know, everybody couldn't do it to make a big book. They took one period in their life that was significant that they wanted to write about. So I come home and I'm involved in a program with our church and our hospital called Care Links. Hmm. And one of the projects I wanted to do with them, and we haven't started, I just talked about it to them, is to go to this retirement center and ask them if they would like to do a project like this, which would be real therapy for them. To take a period in their life and write something about, mm-hmm. no, not their whole life, because that would be too long.
Yeah.
But to share that and maybe publish it, you know, they're doing there. I thought it would also work in your churches.
Yeah.
Elderly people who really have some good stories to tell. Mm-hmm. It would be fun to hear them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's therapeutic as well.
Mm-hmm. And all that stuff is lost, of course, if we
right.
don't tell those stories.
Mm-hmm. I have a history one too.
Good.
So it's not too long. I saw Judy last week at the annual meeting, and when I saw her, I was surprised how I still looked at her for approval and affirmation after all she'd done to make my life miserable at work. I still wanted her to say you were right and I was wrong. She and I worked together from 1987 through 1991. I was in charge of the human resources computer system. She was in charge of the programmers who supported us. She was a very bright, talented, angry, and bitter person. Caustic and funny, both. She seemed always to feel the need to be right. She needed a victim, and she found me. I was the cheerful one, the one who felt the need to get along, the conciliator. For 4 years, as we put a new system in, we fought and we argued, and then we went on and worked together. Over and over, just when I thought we had mended our fences, she'd go off on another tirade, telling her boss, my boss, anyone who would listen, how difficult I was to work with, and the cycle would start all over again. Finally reached the point that I was ready to quit. I wanted a divorce. I was done fighting. My boss, whose contributions up to that point had been, you've got to get along with her, was at a loss. He'd been unable and unwilling to deal with the whole issue, but now what was he supposed to do? So I called the Employee Assistance Program. I went for counseling at church. I saw Joseph in the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, which I think was the best thing. And I learned once again that this wasn't my fault. She was abusive, and that was all there was to it. And Judy quit. Life was good. It became obvious to all that I was very good at working with people and blah, blah, blah. I had been vindicated in the eyes of all. And last week I saw Judy. She didn't talk to me. She didn't say what I still wanted to hear, and I'll never hear.
She quit?
She quit. It's a gift from God.
There was a real triumph there, wasn't there?
Yeah. Yes.
I like the way you circled it around, and then and last week I saw Judy again at the end. I thought that tied it up nicely and made us all realize that even though you'd had that triumph in there, it played you in some way.
And she did. She left it open what she wanted to hear, which I thought was good. She didn't tell us, so that we could plug that in.
Yeah.
I think it's great the way you overcame being a victim.
Yeah, I have just a very small piece. I will never know what it's like to be abused. But I have this. And my boss didn't stand up for me, and it feels like as an abused child, my mother didn't stand up for me. And it was just a real interesting experience.
Yeah, but similar things. It's also personal, it's from my past, but I had a stepmother, and coming to Holy this week, I was really afraid, but also wanted to go to the stepmother and things, but I couldn't do it. So when you said hard thing, that's the first thing I wrote down, that I was afraid to go to the stepmother workshop, and I was a little annoyed by the fact that this wicked stepmother idea was laughable, because I had one, you know? But it was the same kind of thing where my stepmother always, it was never resolved, you know, like that, but I kind of won, because I got to leave instead. I don't have my glasses, I guess I do. When I was 10 and living with my stepmother, she was to find any grease on the dishes I had washed, I had to take down every dish from the cupboards in the dining room that were my mother's to be used before her. And this meant climbing up on a chair and opening high doors by their knobs. I had to reach every dish, dry it, and put it back. I don't know how long it would take me to do this, but I remember feeling overwhelmed with the burden of the task and shame. The sink I washed the dishes in was also where she had me wash my brush and comb with ammonia, and it was where she was sitting or standing at the kitchen table when I came to her crying silently with my underpants bearing blood I didn't understand. She said, "Anyone else can tell when they're going to have their period. Didn't you know so you could not get your underpants dirty?" I must have been 11 then, old enough to light the gas burner on the kitchen stove that we used for heat in the kitchen in the winter. This is in Alaska, by leaving the oven door open. To light the high blue flames on the burner that could fume up in my face if I finally had the courage through my tears to engage the flame of my wooden match to the place inside the burner where it ignited. I would beg not to do it again, but she enjoyed my fear. At lunch, she would have me tap my spoon on the table until she told me to stop. But it was the same kind of thing where I got to leave, and my father finally realized what was happening, and I got to leave. But there was never a closure, you know, so it was similar.
So if you kept writing that story,
well, I mean, I would have liked her to have said something to me when we saw each other again, but it was never anything, it was, you know, never a closure. But that's the word I feel.
Right. Maybe in the story you could write something.
Yeah.
I don't know what that would do emotionally.
Yeah.
In real life, I want to tell you, go to that woman, life or death, and tell her off. Read her out.
Well, compared to a lot of children's abuse, it was mild, but it was...
No, but it was
not very mild.
No, mild to me.
Sadistic.
It's sadistic, that's right. And the language we use to describe it is so compelling and vivid.
Were there other children in the family that were abused also?
No.
No, just you?
I missed the last part. Did you go tell her off?
Pardon?
Did you go tell her off?
You'll appreciate this. I was 11 years old, and I went to a summer Bible camp, and I went to her and I said, "Jesus has forgiven me, and I hope you will too." And she just went into a fury and sent me to my room. So, but I remember doing that. So I did tell her off.
It's a remnant of strength that you did.
At 11.
Good
that
for you. Well, we may have time for one more. Kathy, did you write one?
Yeah, I did. It's pretty heavy. Are you sure you want to hear it? In the summer of 1990, our family was moving from one town to another. Our oldest daughter had, who was grown up by that time and had left her husband and children, was pregnant and had been told by social services that if she didn't go into drug treatment, the baby would be taken away. And she had been through treatment before, but she was 25 years old or something by this time. So she asked my husband and me to help go through the family part of the program. And we said we would. And what was interesting about it was that she was doing it in Spokane. I was still in where we used to live, and my husband was two hours north of Spokane. My husband was already working 2 hours south of Spokane. So we would meet in Spokane for these three family days, which I realized later was kind of interesting that we were meeting in the middle somewhere for our daughter. As part of a program, our daughter had been asked to write her autobiography. Our daughter was adopted. We adopted her when she was 7. She had been sexually and physically abused her whole life, from the time she was born. And she wrote a lot of that in her autobiography, had never told us before, but said her counselors had told her to share this with us. And she said, I want you to read this, but I'm scared to have you read it. And she explained she didn't want me to be hurt by this. And I can't really remember if she shared this with my husband or not. But anyway, she showed it to me, and a lot of it I had suspected anyway, but she was scared to share it to me with me, and she finally had, which was neat. And we hugged and talked, and I remember sitting in that hospital room, her treatment center was a hospital, and thinking, this is the Pam that is the angel that God gave us to live with us, instead of that other Pam that runs around and sleeps with guys and takes drugs and does all this crazy stuff that I do not understand. I do not understand. I do not understand it. But here's the Pam I know, the angel. The other one is gone someplace. And I remember thinking, and I think we said it to each other, but it doesn't really matter if we did or not, because we both felt it, that no matter what, it went something like this. No matter what happens after this, we have this moment together, mm-hmm. as mother and daughter. Mm-hmm. She went through the treatment and was successful to a certain extent, but then later on she relapsed and the baby was taken away. And this daughter is no longer living, so I guess the story doesn't have an end that's anyone that I would like, but it has an end in the sense that I have that moment in that mm-hmm. in that hospital room to hang on to. Because mm-hmm. when she died, she was back on the streets. And but it's that angel part that and I can't explain it, and it sounds corny, but I really felt like God had given this girl to us to teach us how to love and accept other people who are different from us. Mm-hmm. Because to have a daughter who's a prostitute and a drug addict is not something we would have predicted, you know. But I learned to be loving and accepting of people who are not like me. And people today that I know, I'm a pastor's wife too, and lots of people I know don't want to hear that stuff, or they're uncomfortable hearing it, but if they could understand for 2 minutes how their lives would change if they could see life differently than the way they see it in their typical white middle class way. Mm-hmm. Our daughter was black also, so mm-hmm. you learned a lot of stuff that can't be verbalized. Just stuff about everything isn't the way there are other people have lives that are different from ours, and we can learn from them.
And they can be a gift from God.
Yeah. Other people are a gift who are different from us, are a gift from God to show us something, and they make our lives richer. Pam made our lives richer for the 25 years we had her. 25 minus 7, she was 7 when we got her. Excuse me.
And her life was a gift from God.
Yeah, the fact that she lived, that she was born.
And that moment in the hospital is so important to your story.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing.
I think it's probably the pivotal moment in my whole life to share the truth.
Oh, that if we had limited our stories today to stories of children.
Yeah.
Those stories are all small.